Okay, so topic is going to be halachic wills, meaning wills not meaning I want to do something, or wills rather a document dictating how I would like my estate to be divided up amongst my inheritors. So for starters, just to ask you guys, what do you think, why would a person generally write a will? What'd you say?
He wants his assets to go to a specific person.
Right, so very, very, and you know, lo aleinu, but everyone, Baruch Hashem, will have inheritors or people that they want their estate to go to, and if you don't dictate who exactly it will go to, then there's no telling what's going to happen after you pass away. And there might be different circumstances. You might have some children, and you want, you know, maybe some of your children are wealthier than others. Maybe there are extenuating circumstances, whatever the case may be. So that's just generally, and wills aren't only, by the way, about money. They're often also, although that's what we're going to focus on, financial wills, but they're also about custody of, you know, children in case you pass away early. You can dictate other things in your will in terms of who you want to be a guiding force in your inheritors' lives. The other complication here, though, is as follows, okay? So, the Torah has a particular Seder Hayarusha, which means that the Torah tells us that when a person passes away, certain people inherit them and get their things. Now, you might not necessarily want your estate to be divided the way the Torah prescribes. We'll see in a second why that might be. Anyone have any guesses?
Well, I mean, it all goes to the son, right?
Right. Well, the sons, but so one obvious one is that you might have daughters and want them to inherit also. We'll see exactly what usually happens, but that might be one case. So you might have a reason to... There's that also. We'll talk about that. It's not a joke. So, you don't like one of your kids, or you really like one of your kids, or, you know, you really like your nephew. I mean, whatever the case may be. But the Torah does say how the Yerusha generally works. So there's this issue. On the one hand, I have what I want to happen after I die in terms of my estate. On the other hand, the Torah prescribes something that might be different. Now, there are two issues going forward, right? Well, so one question is a practical one, meaning, can if I write a will it work? Why might not it work? Anything else on? Okay, so good. Good. So the Torah tells you what happens. So just because you write something in a will, that doesn't mean that necessarily that will be binding. What type of thing would be binding? Just before we get to the sources themselves. If I wanted to make sure that my inheritors got certain property, what might I be able to do, generally? When you want somebody to have something, what do you do?
Give it to them.
So we have to find a way to enable the person writing the will to give their property to their inheritors. That's point one. So one question is efficacy of a will. Is it even going to work? I can write whatever I want, but will Jewish law respect that? And what makes it more complicated is, obviously, that we don't only have to deal with Jewish law, but we have to deal with secular law. So even if something is an effective way of giving over your property in Jewish law and halacha, it might not be respected in secular law, and then that gets even more complicated. So it's obviously a very complicated issue. There's another question, though, which is, even if I determine that I am able to write a will and it will be carried out the way I would like it to be, what else might be there? Well, the Torah said that when you die, there is a certain order of inheritance. And what question might you ask if you want to write a will? Is it appropriate to change the order of Yerusha the way the Torah prescribed? Meaning, even if I can find a way to get around the Torah's Seder HaYerusha, I can find a way to make sure that my daughter gets a certain amount, my son gets a certain amount, and this son gets a certain amount, and this nephew gets a certain amount, whatever it is, or my wife, for example, gets a certain amount, right? Because according to Torah law, the wife, although she is taken care of, there are certain debts that are owed to the spouse of the deceased, but she doesn't get a regular inheritance, right? Big issue. So The question is, even if that's true and I can make that happen, is that what the Torah wants from me? Is there an ethical issue in not obeying a Torah Seder HaYerusha and finding a way to do something that isn't consistent with that? Okay? So that is the issue. Someone raise their hand. Nathan, was that you? Any questions? Or was it?
I was
going to
raise my hand about like the ethical part, and then you kind of just brought it up.
Oh, my bad. All right.
That's even
better. Okay. So let's take a look. Yeah, well.
Are there people nowadays who actually, I mean, I don't know if you even know this, but who actually do what the Torah says, like just the sun and...
I'm sure there are. I mean, obviously, let's think about it. That's an important issue to discuss, right? It's not, this is not simply a black and white issue. You could say, well, the Torah says... you have to give it all to your son. But what might be the obvious counter argument to that?
You don't have any son.
Well, then you get it to your daughters. That's fine. But, you know, what about shalom? What about peace? What about, it's not necessarily going to be such a peaceful relationship. What?
Torah isn't really commanding.
Okay, so good. And it doesn't say you should. I mean, okay, let's see in a second about that. We'll see that in a second. Yeah, so clearly, I mean, and this is important to realize that, as unfortunate as it is, big disputes and arguments often occur because of issues like this. Issues of inheritance, issues of I wanted to get this, and she wanted to get this, and it wasn't fairly distributed, and there's arguments for the world, and it goes to court, and it can really tear apart families. And you want to make sure that your family will get along with each other after you pass away. Obviously, every parent will want that. So it's complicated. So let's explore a little bit. So for starters, the Torah. Let's explore just a basic idea. Seder Nachalos. Okay, the Torah does, as we said, prescribe a particular order for Yerusha. So let's see. Look at their source one. Elbnei, this is actually in Parshas Pinchas. If you remember the story with Beno Slachad, when the daughters of Slachad were upset because Slavcha didn't have any sons, and because of that, they thought they were not going to get an inheritance. So then Moshe asks Hashem, and he tells him the story. Perfect, Shkayach. And, okay, two pages. Oh, he's got double-sided, so hand one out to everybody. Thanks. So Hashem then tells Moshe, okay, you know what, they're right. They do get inheritance, and here is the Seder HaYerusha. This is what happens. This is the way a person's assets are divvied out when they pass away. So let's look at the post for a second. El Bnei Yisrael Deber Amor, to the Jewish people you shall say, Ishki Amos Vivin Lo, a person that passes away, they do not have a son, Pavartem Es Nachal Aso Levito, you shall pass over their inheritance to his daughter. Vimein Lo Bat, Nintzatem Es Nachal Aso Le'echav, he does not have a daughter, you shall give his inheritance to his brother. Now, by the way, anybody missing from that equation? So we went from son to daughter to brother.
Not wife, yeah.
Well, wife, that's a good point. Anybody else? Think of your sound relatives?
Father.
Father. So that Chazal end up reading into that sort of the way Yerusha works, as we'll see in a second, is that how does the brother get it? Really, the Yerusha, the inheritance, goes to the father, and then from the father goes back down to the brothers.
Even if the father's alive?
Only if the father's not alive.
Okay. Theoretically, if the father was alive, it would go to him.
Yes, and that's how I'm seeing. But in the Torah, it's not explicitly mentioned. Just to kind of re-advertise, there's in terms of Hilchos Yerusha, the way Yerusha works in Halacha is a very interesting topic. You look at it, mostly it's in Perek Yishnochalin, in Bava Basra, the 8th paragraph of Bava Basra deals with this. And there's a question in certain cases, is an inheritor a direct inheritor, or are they sort of an indirect inheritor? Do we view a brother as a directly getting the inheritance from the deceased, or do they really get it from the father? Anyways, so we say, okay, so you don't have a son, it goes to the daughter to the brother. And if you don't have brothers, then the inheritance goes to the uncle, the father's brother. And then that's the Kal Vachomer. If the father's brother gets, certainly the father gets. So that's how the Torah, the Gemara, Rabbanan learned that out. And if the father does not have brothers, then you will give the inheritance to the Sheiroa Karovi Love, the closest relative. Here, The Gemara says that Sheiro doesn't only refer to a relative, it sometimes refers to a spouse. That's one way of referring to the spouse, and based on this, essentially the Gemara ends up learning, although it's a machlokas, whether it's just a rabbinic or a biblically ordained rule, that the spouse, specifically the husband, is first, actually. The husband is first in Yerusha, and everybody follows from him. Anyways, so if there are no, then you give it to the close relative. Okay, we move to the Rambam Hilchos Nachlos. The Rambam is going to elucidate the entire order of inheritance, as the Rambam. Nimtzei Zomer, so we end up saying, Habein kodem chol yotzei shel ben kom levas. The sons are before any daughters, and it's not just the son that's before any daughters, but all of their descendants. So, the way that it works ends up being that if you have any sons, even if the sons pass away, if they have any children, those children will precede the daughter in inheritance.
Even if the son only has a daughter.
Correct. Because the daughter stands in the place of the son. That's how Yerusha works. It goes downward, then back up again. So you have the primary inheritors, they take precedence, and all their descendants take precedence, and if that slot sort of is no longer applicable, it goes to the next slot, which would be the daughter. Okay? And the daughter is before her grandfather, meaning the deceased's father, because the father is next. All of her descendants precede the grandfather. And then the grandfather, or the deceased's father, precedes all of the deceased's uncles, all of the deceased's father's brothers, because they are an extension of him, in a sense, that they only inherit because of the father, meaning the father is a direct inheritor, and then his brothers inherit from him. So that's why the father comes first. V'ach kodem la'achos. And then the brother comes before the sister. V'chol yotzei reichos shel akum en la'achos. And all the brother's descendants come before sisters. V'achos kodem eslavi avia. And then the sister comes before her grandfather. V'chol yotzei reichos kodem en la'avi avia. Avia im konachia av, etc. So you see that this is the way it works. You have a certain, usually men come before women in terms of level. So it's son, then daughter, then father, then it's after father is brother, and then sister, and then uncles, and etc. Okay? So that is how it works. Now, just to point out, in Jewish law, although we'll see in a second, this is the Torah law. Actually, we can even skip to source 6 for a second. Look at source 6. This is Shulchan Aruch. Misha meis v'hiniach banim v'vanos. Yeshua banim kol nechasim v'heim zanim achol yoseim. So a person passes away and he leaves daughters and sons. So the sons get all the property and then they have to sustain their sisters, right? So it's not as if we are leaving the daughters cut and dry. Like, okay, you're going to starve if you have no way of supporting yourselves. Right? The halacha is that the sons are required to take care of the daughters with the estate. They have to make sure they have sustenance. Okay? Until they grow older or until they get married. And then, that's only if there's enough property for the sons to sustain themselves and for the daughters. To sustain them, and for them to sustain their daughters. Ad shivagru rabbanos, until the daughters grow older. Aval im ein benachasim sheniach lapachos mizeh, if the estate does not have enough for both the sons and the daughters, motziyam mehem mezonos levonos ad shivagru, daughters take precedence until they grow up. Okay? Vinosim ashaar lebanim, and the sons get the rest. V'im ein shom elekadim mazon abonos belvad, and if there's only enough for the daughters, what happens? Zizos me'em achivagor achidarsu, they again take precedence until they grow older or they get married. V'abonim yishaldu absachim, and what do the sons need to do? Go from door to door begging for money. So, what the Chazal, and this is part of the Ksuva, what the Chazal instituted was that although sons take precedence in Yerusha, but that only is in a case in which that there's enough money for everybody. Otherwise, the daughters take precedence. So then, if I would ask you, why do you think it is that generally the males take precedence in Yerusha? From a logical perspective?
They can do stuff with it.
Good. Good. Meaning, what would happen if they didn't get the Yerusha?
Also, the daughter would marry someone.
Exactly. Meaning. Exactly. Meaning, the point is that, and then again, this is sort of the philosophy behind it. It's not explicitly written in the Torah, but the assumption is that a man is going to be the one responsible for supporting himself. So the sons need the estate because they're the ones in charge of the estate. They're the ones who are in charge of making themselves money. A daughter, the assumption is that she eventually will get married to another male, and they will support them. So, in a situation in which there's enough for both, they get support until they get married, and the assumption is when they get married, then they will be supported by their husband. In the case that's not true, then the daughter does end up getting sustained from the estate.
The daughter's not getting the nacha. The nacha is going to the son.
Correct.
The daughter's taking stuff from the son to give.
Correct. 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 Okay?
If the males are the breadwinner, I don't understand why they should get the inheritance.
Well, they need
the opposite.
They need to be the breadwinner. That's the point.
No, but like I'm saying,
they're making money.
They're
making money off the land.
That's a good point. Part of the way they make money is from using their father's estate. It's like a family business. It doesn't always work the way it used to. But it's just because of their responsibility. Be that as it may, so that is the way, in our Torah, we have a certain state of Yerusha. You can see how this might not necessarily be the way you want to divvy up your property. Regardless of what we just said, your daughter also, might want a stake in your property, even if she has brothers. If a person passes away, lo alinu, in an early age, and their spouse, their wife, is, or the opposite, but the opposite, it wouldn't be an issue because the husband takes precedence. However, if one's wife is the one who they want to be in charge of their estate, both in terms of having the money and in terms of being the custodian for their children, this is not accounted for directly in the Torah, right? It does not go to the wife. And so clearly there are going to be issues with just abiding by the natural Torah inheritance. And I will mention that there is a tradition in Jewish law of leaving tzava, many rabbanim will leave a will, a commandment to their descendants as to what they should do, not only in terms of the money, in terms of the ways they should act, and their minhagim, their customs, and certain behaviors. But this is part of Jewish tradition, even though we do have a Seder Yerusha. Just want to mention one more thing before we get into how we do a will. There is a little bit of flexibility, even in just general halacha, without any wills, in terms of divvying out your property. And we see that from source number 4. Okay? This is the Gemara in Bava Basra. Ha'omer ish ploni yersheni b'makom sheish biti. B'ishbas biti tersheni b'makom sheish ben. The Mishnah says, a person says, you know what? I want my daughter to inherit my property, even though I have sons, or I want a random person, to somebody that's not immediately related to me, to inherit me, even though I have daughters. Lo amar klum, it doesn't make a difference if he says that. Doesn't matter. Okay. Shehisna mashkas b'Torah. Why? Because he has made a stipulation against the Torah law. Right. If you just say I want X to happen, but the Torah says otherwise, doesn't work. Right. So even if I say I want my daughter to get a piece of my portion, Mishnah says, doesn't matter, it goes to the sons. Okay. V'yochanan b'baruch omer al misha ro'e li yorsho devarav kayamin, v'al misha ein ro'e lo li yorsho ein devarav kayamin. V'yochanan b'baruch argues and says, no. If a person says this about one of his actual yorshim, one of his inheritors, then it works. You have the ability to do this, to pick one of your inheritors and give them more or less, depending, assuming that they are really one of your inheritors, as things stand. But somebody who is not one of your inheritors, you cannot then give them any part of your inheritance, because that goes against Torah law.
So you can't just go to, like, John Doe and give him part of your inheritance.
Right, as an inheritor.
Inheritor here, is it like the extended heir? Like, if you have a son, can you then give it to the daughter instead?
Ah, good question. So it seems to be that you cannot. Meaning, what he means is, and we'll see in Shulchan Aruch in a second, what Rav Yochanan Baruch means is that you can give one son more than the rest, for instance. Or you can give one daughter among others. But he does not mean that once, for this particular rule, once somebody precedes the other party in the law of inheritance, let's say the daughter would not even be considered an inheritor in this situation. Yes, she has a connection to the deceased, and she in some situations would be a yoresh, in this case it wouldn't count. So that's actually clear in source number 5. It says this is Shulchan Aruch in Hilchos Nachlos, Sirin Reish Pialas Savalas. Ein Adam Yachol Horish Mishe No Royal Yerusho. A person cannot give his inheritance to somebody who is not fit to inherit him. V'lo la koha yirsham erorish. And he cannot do this. He cannot uproot inheritance from an inheritor. Bein shetzivu hubari, bein shetzivu b'shimera, bein alpeh, bein b'chtav. Whether or not he is healthy when he does this, or when he is on his deathbed, there is a unique dispensation, as we'll see in Halacha, to give out your possessions when you were on your deathbed. But in this case, it doesn't matter. If you are giving it to somebody who is not one of your inheritors, it does not make a difference whether you write this down in a contract or you do it orally. Lefikach ha'omer is ploni b'chor li t'pel shnayim. Oh, I wanted to mention that. Part of the reason we're doing this is because this is Parsha. If you look at source 3 quickly, it says a person has two wives. One is beloved, one is not beloved or hated. And he has children from both. And the b'chor is from the hated wife. So when he gives out his inheritance, he has to choose the son of the hated wife, even though he doesn't like her as much, and he gets double portion, right? That's what this is, Parsha, that you cannot rob your firstborn of his inheritance, which is double, which again creates other problems, because you might not necessarily want your firstborn to get double your inheritance. What if your firstborn is, I don't know, a wealthy investment banker or something like that, and your second son is like learning in Kailo, right? I mean, like, you don't necessarily always want your firstborn to get double portion, and the Torah says that you cannot stop him from doing that. And therefore, it says the Shulchan Aruch, you cannot say that my firstborn son will not get double portion. You cannot say Ishtoni Bani, second line of source 5, Lo Yireh Shemachov will not inherit his brothers. Lo Amar Klov doesn't work. However, and this, the Shulchan Aruch here actually follows, sorry, Ishtoni Yershin Bagam Sheyeshlo Bas, Biti Tershin Bagam Sheyeshlo Bain, Lo Amar Klov Mechen Kol Yodz Vazeh. Okay, all these cases where you're getting somebody who wouldn't have inherited otherwise to be one of your inheritors doesn't work. Aval. If a person has many inheritors, like many children, many sons, or many daughters, or many brothers, he says when he is on his deathbed, we limit it to that case, interestingly enough, meaning only one of my brothers is going to inherit me, one of my daughters is going to inherit me, or you give more to one than the other, you don't divide it evenly, it works. That works. So you could pick one son over another, or you could give more to one son over the others, or and one daughter over the others. That does work. And again, that's actually from this past week's parsha. It says, "Bayom hanchi lo espanav," when he actively gives his inheritance to his children. Rabbi Yochanan learns from that that the father or the deceased has a role in divvying out his inheritance. Meaning, part of the question is something to think about. Sort of whet your appetite for this idea. Is inheritance something that just happens? It just kind of happens that way? Like the Torah is the one giving the properties to somebody else? Or does the person who passes away have an ability to actively give their property to one of their inheritors? Rav Yochanan is suggesting from the Lashon of Yom Hanchilo Epanov, when he gives out his inheritance to his sons, it means that he has an active role and can actually decide that he's going to give his property or funnel his property to a particular party. Either way, nevertheless, we certainly have certain limitations, right? Clearly, if I just leave things the way the Torah wants them, it won't necessarily always work out, right? Your wife might be angry at you, or your daughter might be angry at you, or many, many problems can happen. One of your sons is going to be jealous about the eldest son. And whether they're right about it or not, but these things can happen. You don't necessarily want to allow that. And you also might want, even on your own, to divvy up your properties in a different way. So how do we deal with this? Okay, so one option is that, okay, you know what? I'm going to write a will according to secular law. with the, you know, I'll go to somebody, to a lawyer, they'll write out my estate for me, and we'll write the will, and it will be enforced. The government will enforce it, you know. Canada is, the government of Canada is going to act upon your will. Like, they don't necessarily know from Hilchos Nachalos. They didn't read the Rambam and Hilchos Nachalos, so they're going to do it. And okay, fine, that's what's going to happen. So what might be the problem with that?
Doesn't it automatically go to the children as soon as he dies? If
according to... Okay, good. Let's say, but let's say I do it anyway.
What?
Well, let's say I want to do it anyway. Okay.
And you're being over on Magic to Batuak.
Okay, good. And what about the children?
They're stealing.
Good, they're stealing. They're stealing. They're like,
unless
stealing.
You say the government just to be proper.
Ah! So the question is, though, does, when the government does something, does that have any legitimacy?
Yeah, why not?
They tax it.
What do we call it when the government does something and that has legitimacy halachically?
Dina
de machulta. Dina de machulta. So would that work in this case? Now,
but
yes,
if you stipulated in your Canadian whatever law, will, the code, whatever the government one, right, that it should all go to your son. So if that would work with Canadian law, which I'm assuming it would if you were clear about it, then you have no excuse.
Well, the question is, again, is that legitimate halachically? If I could write, if I write something in my Canadian will and it's not legitimate halachically, meaning the Torah says, I don't care what you write in your Canadian will, it doesn't work, okay? So then essentially what will happen is the government will enforce it. They will give your things to... they will give your things to the son, or whatever it is, but the son will not halachically own them. He will essentially be stealing property from the other inheritors, or his brothers, or whoever it is. So even though the government gave them to him, it doesn't necessarily mean it's legitimate halachically. Okay? So, what is the real issue here? Let's say, without writing a secular will. So, you look at source number 7, we'll just, what the Gemara essentially says is, and we'll just go to end up going, we won't read it inside for time's sake, but there's the problem here is you cannot give somebody property after death. Right? In order to do a kinyan, you need to be alive. You need to have ownership over your property. Correct? So if I want to give you a gift, I can do that because I own it. If I want to give you this phone, I own the phone. If I give it to you, I have that right. If I didn't own it, let's say it was somebody else's phone, if I stole it, then it would not be yours, even though I gave it to you. The second a person passes away, what happens?
It's not his.
It's not his. And the acquisition will then no longer work. It doesn't work. It halakhically didn't go through. It just goes to Yorshim right away. That's one. Two, what could I do maybe? I could give them before I die. But I might not want to do that. I might not want to do that because I might want control of my assets.
Can you make some sort of contract where it like kicks in the second?
Good. Year? Yes, maybe you can. Maybe you can.
Yeah,
okay.
Brera.
Maybe you can. Brera is interesting, but maybe you can. Okay. So anyway, that's Gemara in source 7. And number, if you look at source 8 in Shulchan Aruch, Bari Sheomer Kisvu Tnu Sarazel Leploni Mechayim Kosev Enos Nim Ilohad Rebbe. If I say that give my field to X, Y, and Z person, I write that. If he's alive, if I say I want it when I'm alive, so then you do it. You fulfill that request. If he does not retract before the recipient gets the contract. Meaning once the recipient gets that contract, deal's done. It's a kinyon, it's an acquisition, and then it's his. Before that, I can retract. However, after he's dead, you are not allowed to fulfill his wish unless they did a kinyan before he died, right? You cannot give your assets to anybody. You cannot transfer them after you're dead. That is our problem. So I made a will. If the will doesn't kick in till after I'm dead, then my inheritors own my property.
Even if it's written down?
Even if it's written down. Because if it didn't happen before I'm dead, even if I wrote, I want this to happen, since the acquisition is now occurring, and I don't even own the assets anymore, so I don't know how to do that. And if the government then goes and gives it to them, then they're just really stealing. Now, That being said, Rav Moshe here in source number 9, actually the question for Rav Moshe was an interesting one. He was asked about a husband whose wife wrote in her will that she wanted to give a lot of money to tzedakah and didn't really want that to happen. So the discussion was a few things, and one of them was, is that will binding? So Moshe says, "Be'etzem mistaber lefi ani d'staiti." It seems to me, according to my humble knowledge, my humble opinion, "Tzavah kazu shevari yekain gedivri mitzvah bedida d'malchusa." A will like this, which will certainly be upheld in accordance with the wishes of the commander, meaning the deceased. Because of Dion de Malchuta, because of the government, Ein Sar Kinyan, She'ein Lecha Kinyan Gadol Mizeh. You do not need an acquisition because there is no greater Kinyan. Meaning, what Moshe is essentially saying is as follows. What is the purpose of making an acquisition?
What, in your lifetime?
Why? We have these things called Kinyanim, right? Kinyanim means as follows. If I say, I would like to give you my property, that doesn't do anything. You still don't own it. You need to do a formal act which signifies that now you own the thing, right? So if I want Shimmy's computer, Shimmy says, take your computer. I have to pick it up and hold it. You know, I pick it up over my head. Hagbah, beautiful. Now I own it. But if I don't do that, though, even though we said, please take the computer, I don't own it. What is the purpose of that? Why pick it up? What does that show?
Your ownership. That, like, this way there's not everything's, like, have good. Is you want people to have a society where people know who's what.
Good. It demonstrates ownership. Another reason is because it shows that especially when we talk about handing over a handkerchief, right? Like one way we talk about kinyanim, kinyan in halacha usually means I give you a handkerchief and I say you go to a wedding, right? You ever see that when they sign the tanaim? You take a pen and you say, by taking this pen, you accept upon yourself the obligations written on this document. What pen? What is giving the pen to do? The point is, it's a demonstration of my commitment. It shows that I am going through with this. So Rav Moshe says, the whole point of a kinyan is that you're showing you're committed, that you're going to do it, that you're really giving away these assets. If you know that by writing this will, it will definitely happen, it is being backed up by the government, they will enforce what's written in this document, then there is no greater amount of a commitment than that. You are certainly committing yourself to doing what's happening, and that is a kinyan. So Rav Moshe suggests, and he says maybe this is why people rely on secular wills, Rav Moshe suggests that even if you don't have a halachic kinyan taking place here, such that it would follow the rules of halacha and enable you to give over your assets to the people you want to inherit them, nevertheless, because the government will enforce the will, that signifies your commitment to fulfilling it, and that takes the place of a kinyan. So it is possible that a secular will indeed works. Possible. That is one thing. It may be that just by writing the will without any particular halachic mechanism, that might work also. What might be a problem with doing this? What do you think? Just using a secular will? Well, first of all, not everybody agrees to this. Not everybody agrees that a secular will work. And even if you feel confident that I follow Rav Moshe, or let's say you're not so religious, for instance, a person's not religious, but what might happen is that the people inheriting them are religious, and they might want a halachic will. Meaning, if you tell somebody, oh, well, you know, you're whoever it was you got this property from, just did a...
If all parties agree to do something else, they can't. Why can they not? Like if I give you $1 million and I say, I don't want $1 million, you know, I'm not going to take $1 million. Instead, I want to have $500,000 and I want to give him $500,000.
That's the case where you want the parties to go to charity, though.
Okay, so but my point, though, is that that's exactly what the parent doesn't want, right? I wrote a will, or chas v'shalom. A person writes a will, okay? I don't know, chas v'shalom is really warranted there. Whatever. A person writes a will, okay? And they want that will to be carried out. If they know that their children will be like, nah, you know what? This seems like it's against halacha. Let's just follow the rule of the Torah. That's not what they want. They wanted their children to get the property. You know, that goes against the whole point of writing a will. So... just using secular will, first of all, is not agreed upon by all poskim. What? So that is a good point. Mitzvah l'kayim d'vei ames. There is such a thing. what it's applicable to is not 100% clear always. The other problem is that if you just rely on mitzvah kinds of yamis, will the government always enforce that? Without getting into it too much, generally isn't just assumed that just by doing the mitzvah that it will supersede the Seder Hayarushin in the Torah. Meaning, although there is mitzvah kind of remain, that might mean that I could say pay back this guy or give this person a present. But Yerusha usually takes precedence, right? Meaning, you know, let's say I like Nafti, or someone likes Nafti, and he has no relation to them. He's like, okay, I'm writing you a tzivoy to give Nafti $1 million. Fine. But if his children wouldn't have any money otherwise, right, they take precedence. So mitzvah kinder it won't really be a solution here, although, right, if you're noted that that we do use it for certain things. For instance, you can use it to determine who has custody over certain things or who's going to be the executor of the will, things like that. But to actually give over property, it won't be necessarily an effective mechanism. Okay? Good. So
just to clarify, Rav Moshe's, the way he understands it, is that being that you know that your will is going to be enforced, therefore it's like a kinyan, so that is equivalent to you just giving over all your possessions, like, I don't know, a day before you die? It would work kind of the same way?
Equivalent, yeah.
It just happens to be.
Yeah, yeah, correct. Meaning, exactly. Meaning, when you write the will, that is not a kinyan. You wrote it before you died, but that is not a kinyan. However, Moshe says it's equivalent to a kinyan, and therefore it's enforceable, and therefore that works, and therefore that is a solution. Now, Moshe is not advocating for this, not saying you should rely on a secular will. He's merely saying that if you do, this might actually work. Okay? Good. However, so what are other solutions here? Let's say I want to be, you know, a good halachic Jew, and I don't necessarily want to rely on this particular approach. What are my other options? There are a few, and they're all complicated and have other considerations. So let's just briefly discuss some of them. Okay, so one is what Natan suggested before is, you know what I could do, is I can give over my possessions before I die, right? So basically, this is sort of, instead of, it's not going to be Yerusha, essentially, right? It's not going to be inheritance, but what it will be is like a gift, essentially. And what will happen then is that I'll say, okay, let's say I want my daughter, for instance, to inherit me or inherit some property. I'll say I'm going to give her a certain amount of property. What's the flaw with that? So then you might not want to give it to them right away. So then what Natan say is, okay, so write in the condition that the gift only applies a second before you die. The problem with that, though, is that even if you do that, halachically, the way it works is not so simple. It's not, right, when I give something over to somebody and I do it now, in order for it to take effect, to be legally binding and legitimate, something needs to happen now. So if you look at what the Lashon Hara says here, Hakosim lefachasav livno la'achar moso, hare haguf shel habein mizman hashtar va'aperos la'av ad she'emut. Okay? A person that writes their property to their son for after they die. Now, it can't literally be after they die because then it won't work. So what it means, essentially, is that it will be given to the son. Right, you're giving it to him from now, and it will apply from now, in a sense, but it will also work after you're dead. So, hariha guf shel ben mizman hashtar. What that means is the son owns the principal, meaning what we call it, the keren. He owns the land, but he doesn't get any of the produce from it. Meaning what that means is that let's say I own a field or land or something like that, or even if I own a building or something like that, and I want to give that to my son, I want them to inherit, I want to give it to my daughter, and I'm saying I'm giving it to you. So what happens right away is that they own it.
Even if you say,
but I get the money from it.
Why would they own it if you say this is only going to kick in before I die?
Because it doesn't work like that in halacha. If I'm already committing to give it to them now, if I'm saying, again, you can't give them after you die, okay? I'm just saying, look, if you wanted to wait till literally a second before you died, so then that would be different. But that usually isn't, people don't know when they're going to die, and that usually isn't so practical. So what you're going to do is you're going to write the will at some point well before you die. People write wills when they're young already, because you never know what will happen. And you're going to say, I'm going to give it to you, but it's only going, I'm giving it to you now, but it kicks in right before I die. The way that works practically, luckily, is that I retain the payros, because I said after, right before I die. So I get the profits and things like that, but you own it, which results in me not being able to sell it or do anything with it. I can't use it. It's already yours. It's encumbered to you, but I get the profit from it. Now, the problem with that is not everybody will want to give up dominion and control of their property or assets so early on in their life. Right, you don't. You. The point is that the will isn't for now; it's for later. It's not for now. You want control of your assets, right? And they, you know, and you. Although we try to have great relationships with our relatives, you never know. Like they can deceive you. Like it might not always work out. Okay, so it says the father cannot sell the property because they are given over to the son. And the son cannot sell them because they are in the father's possession. So you know, and that are one of the drawbacks. You look at source 11. If you want to look this paper up, by the way, you can just sort of Google halachic will. This is the paper. It's a really good one. Goes through a lot of issues. Donald Littman and Stephen Reznikov. It says, the transfer of future interest also requires the kingdom to be accompanied by appropriate language. Thus, the transfer wants to retain beneficial ownership until just before death could state. This transfer is from now and until one moment before I die. That's a halachic formulation. By this language, the transfer will retain the right to possession of the property until the moment before death, when that right will vest in the transferee, because at the transfer's death, the property belongs completely to the transferee. The transfer's Torah eyes receive nothing. That's what you end up doing. You give it to the person you want to give it to right before you die, and then they get it, and there's nothing left to inherit. However, yeah.
So what about Brera there?
Brera, but you're choosing somebody. I'm not.
No, I know, but I'm saying, like, if some, let's say there's a transfer, like, let's say there's a sale the moment before the death. Like, right, in Brera, ain't Brera the issue. What?
There's no Brera. There's but when, no possible, there's no things going to change or set between.
No, but I'm saying, if there's a sale from the money that would have gone to the moment before the death, wouldn't it ain't Brera the issue?
He's not allowed to sell.
No, no, I'm, is that so clear?
Sure,
because I'm saying, like, look, point A is right before his death, right? At point A, he sells, the guy who's about to die sells it, sells something, right? Or buys something, whatever, using what would have gone to the inheritor, right? Because if it's a moment before the death.
He's not able to do that.
What?
He's not able to do that. He's not allowed to give something. I mean, like, does he, wait, before he gave, he didn't sign anything to the inheritor before.
No, like,
so, what exactly is the case? Okay, so what are you doing? What are you what exactly are you writing?
The guy's about to die, right?
Okay.
And moment before his death, he's sells his property or something to a third
party. Okay, so that's an interesting question about whether or not that ends up binding, but that's not what we're talking about.
No, right? I know.
But okay,
he just sold it.
No,
he just sold it to
no but I'm saying, but saying it wouldn't have been his because it would have been his inheritor.
Because he already signed the contract before with his inheritor.
The will's already in place.
There's a will already that says the moment before I die, it's going to go to my name. And you think in between.
You can't sell it. You can't sell it.
Why not?
Because you can't sell it. Because already when you say the moment before I die, it's going for my inheritance. Again, there's an issue here, right? You can't break up a kinyan. If you do a kinyan now, it doesn't magically do nothing now and then kick in later. It doesn't work halachically. There has to be some sort of expression of the kinyan when you do it. It's called costa kiano. So what you do is you write, it applies from now and then after death. And then what happens, me'asha v'la'achar misa. What ends up happening is the principal goes to them right now. They own the land. It's in their estate right now, but they don't get to use it until after I die. Or a moment right before I die. Okay? Now, that disables you from selling it or giving it to anybody else, but allows you to hold on to the profits. I still get to, you know, benefit from my property, essentially. So that's the point. As pointed out in number 12, there are problems with this, right? One is the loss of control, right? There are a number of practical and legal drawbacks to the solution, not the least of which is the loss of control by the donor over his or her property. As well, there will be tax consequences to the transfer if there is an accrued gain. right? So if they actually own it now and it goes up in value, the inheritor, the son, the daughter, whoever it is, will have to pay taxes on that. And that might not necessarily be what they want. So there are drawbacks, but that might be one solution. Normally that's what's usually done. Okay. So that's solution number one. Give it as, it's called an inter vivos gift, which essentially means give it to the inheritor before you die. And then that will work with a certain drawback of you losing control of your property. Okay? I want to hit a few other ones quickly. So there is another idea here, and believe it or not, this is often what ends up being used. This is what the RCA does. If you look at the RCA's formulation of inherited will, it's a modification of what we're about to say. Basically, what you do is as follows. You are allowed to obligate yourself in debt to somebody, even if it's not true. Okay? So I can say, I owe Shimi $1 million. And that ends up being halachically enforceable. Now, I might not owe him $1 million. I don't, as far as I checked, right? We're good? Okay? I don't have $1 million to give you, so if I do, I'm sorry. But I didn't have any, he never lent me money. It's not true. But I am able to obligate myself to somebody else, and that ends up being a debt. Debts take precedence before, right? If you owe somebody money and then you die, your inheritors have to pay off that debt. Okay? So it says, Hamachayev atzu b'mamon la'acher belotznai. A person obligates themselves money. If you look at source number 13, this is from the Shulchan Aruch, Choshen Mishpat Siman Mem. If a person obligates themselves in money to somebody else without any precondition, afa pish lo'achayev lo'kol re'zachayev. Even though he was not actually obligated to him, he is obligated. Ketzad. Ha'omer le'edim havu alai edim shani chayev l'ploni money. A person says to witnesses, be witnesses to me that I owe somebody $100 or 100 zuz. Osha kasav lo b'shtar eni chayev l'chamono. He writes in the star contract, I owe you money. And afa pish shem edim. Osha omer le'edim hareni chayev l'chamono b'shtar. Right, I obligate to you through myself through a contract, or I tell Edim when he's not there that we witnesses that I owe somebody money, or I say to him I am obligated to you, even though he doesn't say Atzim Edai, he's obligated. He is now obligated himself just like an Arev, right? A guarantor can obligate himself to pay back the loan for the person in debt, the debtor, even though he didn't do anything. So I can obligate myself in monetarily, right? So that's a solution. I could say, I am going to obligate myself in this debt. The way that the RCA ends up actually doing it is, if you look, what they say is as follows. You make a condition, you say, let's say, you know, you want your daughter to, or your wife, let's say, to inherit some of your property. So what you could say is as follows. You could say, if you want it to sort of work legally, so actually take a step back for a second. One problem with this is it's not going to be enforceable generally in secular law. Right, look at number 14. I think the same in Canada, but this is American law. As a general rule, American law does not enforce an obligation or deem it legally binding when a person voluntarily undertakes an obligation to another without consideration or a consideration substitute. If I just say I owe you money, I don't actually owe you money. That's not a thing in secular law, usually. So they won't respect it, right? So that gets you into trouble. And now we found it's the opposite. As opposed to a secular will, which is enforceable legally, but not enforceable halachically, now we have a mechanism which is enforceable halachically, but not legally. So what the RCA suggests you do is as follows. You want to suggest something? Okay, meaning?
You do a will, and you make make yourself obligated, just make sure the same amounts in a will that you're going to be obligated halachically, and they'll just both function right next to each other.
Well, you have to kind of tie them together, because then neither of them will work according to both.
No, you don't need both to work. One just works according to secular law and cover your bases there, and one works according to Jewish law.
They don't, but it's going to get complicated, because...
In a halachic will, you're saying, I owe let's say I have five kids and I owe each of them, I'm in debt to them, each of them 20%.
Yeah.
And you're saying that I am giving 20% of my ass. That's not the same as...
No,
so
if you don't get a secular law just to get fill the secular law.
I hear what you're saying. I hear what you're saying, but it might get complicated because of those convictions. What RSA does is they say like, as follows. You obligate yourself in some absurd amount of money to the person that you want it. So let's say the person wants their wife to inherit them. So you say, I hereby obligate myself to my wife $2 million on the condition that my children or my inheritors do not fulfill the obligations detailed in my will. And if they do carry out my will, then I do not owe my wife any money. So essentially, you tie them, you require them to fulfill your secular will. You say, either you obey the instructions in my will and sort of give them out to each other, or you, I am now hereby obligating myself to my wife. So then you kind of what Nathan was saying, you cover both bases. Halachically, tana'im work, conditions work, and you can obligate yourself without any prior consideration. So you will halachically obligate yourself that money if they don't fulfill it. They are going to then go and fulfill your secular will, and that will then be legally enforced. Okay, and that's actually what it's called. What the RCA recommends. I think the term for this in halacha is usually called a shtar chatzi zachar. You write a contract saying that you're obligating your children or your sons to give your wife some also, or your daughter some also. That is one way of dealing with this. That is one method. Okay. Another method, joint tenancy. So what you could do is you could be a joint ownership on your property with your children, right? This is another, says number for story 15. Transferring and holding assets in joint tenancy with children during lifetime may be a solution to the halachic issue of distributing assets to daughters on death, meaning they already own some of it. They're already a partner in my assets. So essentially, it's sort of like the first mechanism in that you're doing something right from now, but you're like a partner with them, such that you still retain control, because just like in any partnership, right, like you get to, in partnership with the person, control your assets. Okay? So that's another issue here. He says, however, in Canada, one must proceed cautiously. There may be tax implications to a transfer to a joint tenancy, as the parent may be considered to be disposing more of half of the property. I mean, depending on the legalese, ask your local Orthodox lawyer, depending on the legalese of exactly what's happening, you're saying we own this together, but that might be viewed as a gift, and that could be taxable, and that would be a problem with that, but that would be sort of another method here. Again, doing a transaction now, entering into a partnership with the person you want to give the assets to, but retaining control because you're a partner. Your partner's together. You own it together. Another idea suggested here is inter vivos trust, which means that you put it into a trust fund. A new suggestion may provide a halakhically viable solution, says Rabbi Chaim Jachter here in source 16, to the Yerush issues in a manner that is consistent with common secular legal and estate planning for many people. This involves establishing a revocable living trust, a contractual arrangement between a person as the grantor and forming the trust, preferably that the person and another person as co-trustees managing the trust. Okay, so you can make a trust fund during the lifetime, during your life, and then you're making somebody in charge of distributing the funds in that trust. That gets complicated. I'm sorry, I'm going a little quickly here, but we're running out of time, and I don't want to keep you late. So that gets complicated in terms of halachically, which assets would actually be able to be transferred in such a way to a trust. You know, trust in halacha can be a pretty difficult topic. We don't usually have such things. We're giving it to a fund. But that's another thing he suggests. So, essentially, in terms of this point in this year, we'll mention the other point in just a second, in terms of how it works, there are different approaches. Each one has its disadvantages and advantages. You need to think about secular law, and you need to think about halacha, and how they go together, and practical ramifications of losing ownership of your property or being taxed on it, and so on. What should I do, though? Let's say I find a way, I take the RCA and I do this Starchat Zachar with the modification that if they don't fulfill my will, they are going to owe X, Y, and Z a lot of money, and then they'll end up doing it. But is that what the Torah wants for me? So this is just another consideration. If you look at source number 17. He did what he did, but the Chacham are upset with him. Rishon Gamliel says, no, if his children weren't acting appropriately, then fine, it's good. So this is a discussion in a few places of the Gemara. Is this something the Torah desires? If you give away your property, even if you find a way to do it, the legal aspect aside, you can give your present to whoever you want, luckily. I can give you all my money as a present right now if I wanted to, but there might be an ethical issue with counteracting the Seder HaYerusha detailed in the Torah. And that's just not what Chachamim want. And there are different, and if you look in the postgame, they say that even if you think your child isn't acting appropriately now, maybe their children will. Maybe their children's children will. You never know how their descendants will act. And therefore, there is an issue here. So, just sort of conclude, Moshe Feinstein notes, that this was generally agreed upon that we do not, even in the case in which a person isn't acting appropriately, try to take away the Yerusha, what should you actually do? So Moshe quotes the Ksos HaChoshen, you're saying, you should leave over a certain amount, a substantial amount of money. He says, Dala Zuze, 400 Zuzim is sufficient. That you leave over a substantial amount of money to your actual inheritors, and in that way, you do fulfill the will of the Torah. There is an inheritance happening here, and you're not violating or completely disposing of the Seder HaYerusha, and then with the rest of your property, you give to the other people in your will. And in that way, you try to, on the one hand, make sure that you give over your property in a way that there will be peace and agreement amongst your family members and things will work out, and at the same time, respecting the Seder HaYerusha and the Torah. And you see, I think, hopefully that's a complicated issue, but it's something to think about, and there are ways of dealing with it, both halachically and legally. Thank you very much, and enjoy the rest of your day.
I have no idea.